company of forward thinkers with more than 55,000 employees around the globe and products in 58 customer countries, Raytheon has established itself as a trusted partner. From detection to action, we give our customers a decisive advantage. Customer-driven, technology-powered, Raytheon, revolutionizing defense capabilities.
Hello, and welcome to the Emerging Tech Horizons podcast. I'm Arun Serafin, Executive Director of NDIA's Emerging Technologies Institute. The Department of Defense is tasked with fielding many military systems that meet America's national security needs. To do so, it constantly strives to strike a balance between fielding new capabilities while upgrading existing ones to provide the military with improved performance to keep pace with changing threats or to integrate innovations generated by the private sector. However, the current state of defense microelectronics poses a significant challenge to modernizing defense systems efficiently in terms of cost, schedule, and keeping DoD up to date with the microelectronics state of practice on a variety of performance metrics. My guests today are Jacob Wynn, one of ETI's associate research fellows, and Dr. Michael Fritzi. The two of them co-wrote ETI's new report to address the challenges I just discussed. You can find that report, Improving DoD's Ability to Use Modern Microelectronics, on our website and in the text box description below. To introduce our guests today, Dr. Michael Fritzi is an independent consultant at TechStrait LLC, a senior fellow and former VP at the Potomac Institute of Policy Studies, and a senior consultant in Trusted Strategic Solutions. His activities have included working on microelectronic policy issues like U.S. government access to trusted sources of supply, support of needed legacy technologies, DoD's innovation policy and outreach to industry, and the overall strengthening of the U.S. microelectronics industrial base. He's also a member of the Industrial Advisory Committee supporting the Commerce Department's work implementing the CHIPS Act. Previously, Dr. Fritzi was the director of the Disruptive Electronics Division at the USC Information Sciences Institute, and prior to that, a program manager at the DARPA Microsystems Technology Office. Dr. Fritzi received a PhD in physics from Brown University, working in the area of compound semiconductor quantum well physics. My other guest, Jacob Wynn. Jacob's research portfolio at ETI includes microelectronics modernization, defense science and technology funding analysis, and many other things. He started out on the strategy and policy team at NDIA, where he worked on issues like intellectual property and DoD's budgeting process. Jacob studied international affairs and political science at George Washington University's Elliott School of International Affairs. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Fritzi and Jacob to today's podcast. So thanks, guys, for joining us today to talk about this important issue. Just to get the conversation started, I'll direct this question first to you, Dr. Fritzi, Mike. What does the broad semiconductor ecosystem look like today, and what is changing about it?
So thanks, Arun, and I really appreciate the opportunity to talk about one of the passions that I have here. I think the microelectronics infrastructure these days is characterized by a rather complex global supply chain. Really preaching to the choir here, I think most people understand that. But what brought that into sharp focus was the COVID pandemic from a few years ago. It actually disrupted our supply chains and in some areas substantially. Just ask the automotive folks, right, who had many, many thousands of vehicles parked without simple microcontrollers to get them off the lots, for example. So that's brought a lot more intention on the security aspects of the supply chain. And I mean, not just basic access, which is important, but also just if you're using an international supply chain, how do you know that your parts have not been messed with? And how do you know that you can get guaranteed access, you know, over a period of many, many years? So those are that's really, I think, what's happened recently is that there's a lot more focus on security concerns. The other big macro trend, of course, is the end of physical scaling, which we've all seen coming for a long time. But what that really means, and I've been in a number of workshops in the past few weeks, is that there's a lot more interest in custom, right, custom solutions rather than generic solutions. And that means really more work done at lower volumes, which I think represents a synergy with the defense world and the commercial world. So those are the macro trends that I see, Arun.
So when I think about those macro trends, can you relay to our audience how some of those trends and other challenges in the microelectronics world are facing the defense industrial base? How are they affecting the defense industrial base and the Pentagon's ability to get the microelectronics it needs?
Well, there's two things, Arun. One is obviously the speed continues to be rapid and increasing. Despite the fact that Moore's physical scaling is slowing down, the number of things changing in electronics is very, very quick. And so the pace is more rapid than ever, and yet our acquisition system has to catch up with that. And by that, I mean the defense acquisition system, because it's designed based on fairness and the process. And to make that compatible with the speed of commercial execution is a big, big challenge. And I'll get a little bit more specific there, and that's defense systems tend to be big, complex platforms for defense platforms. And so they're deployed for many, many decades typically. And so they need to be sustained, for example. And that is a perennial issue. How does the defense world assure sustainment of big system platforms for defense over a period of decades when the commercial industry moves on over a period of years and often end of life parts, for example? So that is a perennial challenge of how do you achieve sustainment? In fact, one of the motivators for this work that we worked, this paper that we wrote, was how do we encourage better and more effective modernization, right? Because sustainment is a huge, huge perennial challenge for the defense world. I mean, sustainment over a period of decades.
Yes, so ETI actually began this project back in 2022 when we ran a workshop on the transition of modern microelectronics into defense systems. The goal of that workshop was to inform the participants, but also to inform how ETI would work on the topic of semiconductors in the future. So we brought together workshop participants ranging from NDIA staff to defense industry to government research and acquisition personnel to congressional staff and members of the commercial microelectronics sector. And at the workshop, the group discussed a series of programs at DoD to try to advance the state of the art of semiconductors, such as by improving their computational performance or enhancing their security or reducing their size, weight, and power requirements. But the participants also started to talk about some of the barriers to modernizing these systems, like bottlenecks in the requirements process and the qualifications process. So with that in mind, one of the next steps out of the meeting was for ETI to write a report on how to modernize these systems better.
So with that guidance, then, that's not really a technical deep dive paper that you went into. It's really the how DoD can behave better in getting the systems it needs, thinking about some of those sustainment issues that Mike mentioned earlier. So what was the research process for the overall report?
Yeah, thanks. So first, we conducted some background research. We mapped the stakeholders with some level of leverage over defense semiconductors, ranging from DoD agencies to NIST to throughout the private sector. We looked at the current state of play within the Chips and Science Act implementation and the Microelectronics Commons as well as part of that. And we also looked to the broader state of play in regard to government chip usage, ranging from acquisition to science and technology initiatives. And then we compared that to methods used in non-defense industries like automakers, commercial aviation manufacturers, and other critical infrastructure providers. And then we tried to make sure, after we did that background research, that we included a multitude of perspectives from a variety of key parts of the semiconductor industry, talking about things like the various security standards regimes, differing views on customizing microelectronics, and the role of technical data as well. And through those interviews, one of NDI's strengths is being able to leverage a variety of perspectives from the traditional defense industrial base to commercial companies to our academic members, and then current and former government personnel on both the acquisition and the technical sides. And we interviewed 18 of those experts, with ranging from all of those types of organizations. asking them a variety of questions about incentives and disincentives that might help us upgrade microelectronics more continuously. And we asked them how they would reconstruct modernization plans from their perspectives and dug deep into various processes, like you mentioned, related to acquisition and requirements like the qualification process.
That's great. So can you tell us what you found? What's the overview of what the report's findings are?
Yeah, absolutely. So altogether, we found a variety of challenges related to DoD's organizational structure, some technical challenges that came up a lot in our interviews, and then a set of challenges related to acquisition requirements, and then the programming and appropriations processes as well. So kind of running through a few of those just as an overview, all of them are in the report, of course. One of our key takeaways was that DoD lacks an organization with the sufficient authority and resources to fully assist program offices with their work. So that could include assisting with the acquisition, sustainment, or modernization of their chips. There's important work conducted across all of those areas by agencies like DARPA, the Defense Logistics Agency, and the Defense Microelectronics Agency, but there isn't a centralized enough organization providing a sustained push towards modernizing those microelectronics or providing the staffing support to make that happen. And then on the technical side, one of the first challenges that we found was the degree of knowledge down the tiers and sub-tiers of suppliers of semiconductors. And we found that acquisition professionals and contractors alike can sometimes lack visibility downstream into their microelectronics supply chains, whether because of a lack of access to technical data packages or an insufficient number of program-specific studies. And like Dr. Fritzi mentioned earlier, because we're reaching the end of physical scaling, people mentioned the need to customize more as we modernize, and that will lead to additional considerations as well.
So Mike, Jacob mentioned that one of your findings was that DoD and its contractors often lack detailed information on some of the microelectronics or many of the microelectronics in their systems. I think that's a surprise to some people. Can you talk a little bit more about that and other technical challenges that the DIB faces when it's trying to modernize its microelectronics?
Yes, thanks, Arun. That's a great question, and we probed into that in some depth. So what we found out, and in some ways we suspected some of this, but it was confirmed by a lot of the interviews that went on, is that the defense industrial base, or the government, actually the U.S. government, who's funding the defense industrial base, they rely heavily on contractors for technical work. And I know when I was a younger engineer, the government had more in-house capabilities to at least vet things and test things and do things like that. So they could be a partner. In the old days, and I'm saying a few decades ago, the government was a partner in doing tech development for a military platform. These days, and I don't want to be glib or anything, but often it's thrown over the fence to the contractor to say, this is what we want, you take care of it. And so that means you're making a very heavy reliance on the contractor. You don't even know the bill of materials, for example, because that's not specified in your contract. So if that's the case, you're utterly and totally dependent on them for sustaining that. So you have a custom complex system that's often difficult to sustain. You need parts that are no longer built, for example, and you're totally reliant on the contractor to do it. And that is a big issue here. And one of the things that we wrote in our recommendations is we need better knowledge. And we also need to request more modularity and more IP, frankly. When we issue a contract, request that the platform is modular and more easily upgradable. Put that in the contract language, for example, and absolutely make sure that you own some of the interface IP or that you understand stuff about the IP and how it's handled. Because otherwise, you're locked into a single contractor for life, basically. And that often means a costly end-of-life sustainment bill and without modernization, because that's the easy route to quick money.
So Jacob, in addition to these technical challenges, the report goes into some of the acquisition process and even requirements challenges that are associated with the modernization of microelectronics in our defense systems. Can you talk through that a little bit? What did you find in those spaces?
Yeah, absolutely. And Dr. Fritzi started to touch on this as well. The report found that microelectronic sustainment and modernization needs are just not fully considered during the acquisition processes that occur at the beginning of the program lifecycle, even though sustainment comprises a huge portion of that lifecycle. There are, just like Dr. Fritzi said, there are decisions made about the intellectual property and technical data packages that are negotiated for that can make upgrading microelectronics more difficult later on. And we also heard a lot about the large costs associated with attempting to stockpile those legacy semiconductors through end-of-life purchases, which can often be more expensive than continuously upgrading the embedded semiconductors inside the systems.
So for those in the audience who don't know, what is an end-of-life purchase?
Sure. So an end-of-life purchase occurs when the fabrication facility that the microelectronics system is produced on is ending the end of its facility life and it's being transitioned over to something else, or there's just enough sustainment needs and there aren't enough of the existing system, and it would be too costly to attempt to overhaul the microelectronics that are in the system today. So there's a decision made to try to buy as many of that existing microelectronic as possible before the production line runs cold.
Okay, sorry to interrupt. Keep going.
No worries. And then finally, we also found that in terms of resourcing and the appropriations process, those can often be too rigid to allow for the procurement of the mission-driven capabilities that stay close to the performance of the state of the practice. For example, the colors of money often pose a barrier to modernization because the guidance on whether or not you're using RDT&E money versus procurement money versus operations and maintenance money is often unclear when you're attempting to upgrade microelectronics to see if they clarify should be defined as a sustainment activity, some type of new procurement, or a new development activity.
So in those cases, then you're saying that the colors of money rules dictated by Congress, maybe, or the Pentagon itself, keeps the defense program, the DoD program manager, from modernizing the microelectronics in the system, right? Because they just don't have the color of money that, I don't know, a fiscal lawyer might tell them they need to do that modernization work. Is that right?
Yeah, exactly. They could be told in some cases that modernizing is a sustainment activity, or they could be told that it's a new development as part of upgrading some type of subsystem.
Okay, so you guys found and outlined a whole bunch of findings, which sound like challenges and sound tough. Is there any way out of this? What did you actually come away with in terms of recommendations to fix any of this?
Yeah, absolutely. So the report is full of those attempting to solve some of the big problems that we're talking about here. We talked about earlier how there's no centralized organization systematically offering that expertise to program offices. So we recommended that DoD should designate and definitely fund a centralized microelectronic support activity. We think that that could be established within an existing organization or by merging several of those together. And we think that the organization's goal should be to provide expertise through all stages of the acquisition life cycle. And that could come in the forms of a repository for technical data, a repository of information on how defense programs are using microelectronics. And it could also support market research and other industry interactions, in addition to some studies at the program specific level to figure out what exactly is in particular systems in the hopes of knowing if they need an upgrade at all.
So it sounds like that office would be kind of supporting other people in their efforts to acquire, to buy microelectronics, providing analysis, providing expertise. But I hope you're not falling into the Washington trap of saying we should create a new organization, right? So is that what you're not recommending that? Okay.
No, not recommending a new organization, recommending that an existing organization be empowered in some way to perform these activities.
Okay.
Yep. And then we also got into the details of recommendations on the technical side. the acquisition and requirement side. And I think a good recommendation to highlight there would be the creation of a key system attribute, or KSA, to create incentives for programs to develop technical requirements that support continuous upgrading of embedded chips up front. So that sort of tackles the problem of not exactly putting enough focus at the beginning of the program lifecycle onto whether or not the microelectronic can be upgraded easily in the future. Another recommendation of ours was overhauling the budgeting and appropriations practices to allow operations and maintenance funds, or O&M funds, to be used for continuous upgrade as a standard financial management practice across DoD. Doing that would make another recommendation possible, which would be regularly embedding technology refresh events into program office timelines, just to provide some checkpoints for active market research and technical analysis. And if the funds are there in a regular way, to make sure that any information learned from those analyses can be then adopted into an upgrade or other type of modernization effort, then I think it would work a lot more seamlessly.
So what would you envision would go on in the microelectronics space at one of these tech refresh events?
Yep. So the goal would be to just take a short pause, review threats, review capabilities and what's occurring in the state of the practice or the state of the art commercial technology space, really looking into the traditional defense industrial base, but also into the commercial sector, seeing what the cutting edge trends are and seeing if there is something that can be rapidly moved from the commercial sector into a defense subsystem to improve performance in some way, whether it be size, weight, and power, whether it be computational, or even if there's just a way to make the microelectronics more secure. It's possible at the end of that refresh event, you find that threats for your particular program have stayed similar and that the capabilities are working as intended and that you can skip until the next one, but it just provides that touch point to ensure that there's an opportunity to make that overhaul.
And then, Mike, even if some of these recommendations are implemented, can you walk us through how those changes might address some of the pain points you observe day to day in your work across government, industry, and academia as we're all striving, not just on the DoD side, but on the civilian sector side of the government and even on the industry side at making these efforts to modernize microelectronics and systems?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I sort of lean back on the last couple of decades of working on this field. The first thing, and I'm kind of channeling what Jacob said, except in a slightly different way. The government, especially the DoD, needs to become a better customer for industry. Industry in the microelectronics field does the lion's share of the new development, and they move fast. The industry moves very fast. The government moves slowly according to its rules. And so there is a need for more flexibility. And a number of the recommendations point out the fact that we need to be a little bit more flexible. That's actually foot stomped by some of the efforts recently in the ANS side of the Pentagon when you're talking about, sadly, the current wars that we're facing and shortages of parts that we're facing supporting those wars. There's a move to have more flexible, discussion, Arun, of multi-year contracts, for example. I know I heard that from Bill LaPlante, for example.
Yeah, Dr. LaPlante, who's the Undersecretary for Acquisition and Sustainment, or ANS, has been talking about the multi-year procurement authority for use in munitions, for example.
Yeah, we definitely need to be better customers. So number one, U.S. government needs to take action to be a better customer to industry because industry develops most of the parts that they need. I'll just foot stomp the centralized organization to have a good knowledge of what the DoD needs are across the board is very good. And I'll just add the additional piece that helps with aggregation. Everyone in industry tells me the better you aggregate, the better deal you're going to get and the better security for parts you're going to get. So if you know what parts you need, you can start aggregating into buckets and start placing aggregated orders instead of individual orders. To some degree, the Trusted Foundry does elements of that, but it could be much better, for example. Thirdly, the incentives of modernization, it needs to be directly in the contract, as Jacob said. Today, the system runs until a part can no longer be procured and the system is down, right? And if you still need the system, And I'll use the example of the, you know, the Stingers and Javelins that were used in the Ukraine, for example. Those are decades old technologies. If those parts are down and you can't get them anymore, then there's an emergency situation of an end-of-life buy, for example. If we incentivized modernization right up front, as Jacob mentioned, we might avoid some of those emergency events, because that always ends in tears when you have an emergency that you have to address. And finally, having thought about this a lot, and it's very germane to this report, is the business model. The government needs to work to change the business model with how they interact with the defense industrial base. Today, the lion's share of money from the defense industrial base is made by sustaining old systems. No surprise, I would say up to 3/4 of the money that they make. What we have to do is incentivize, put more money up front in the development and modernization phase. There needs to be more opportunities to make money so that we don't have this lopsided, you know, 20-25% development, 75% sustainment. We move it closer to 50-50. And the government can do things to incentivize that kind of thing. And if we do that, we won't run into as many sustainment crises as we have been over the years.
So, Mike, tie this a little bit to some of the work you're doing in trying to help the government implement the CHIPS and Science and CHIPS Acts. You know, we're making a large taxpayer-funded investment in foundries and in research. DoD's making progress on their network of microelectronics research facilities, the microelectronics commons. Now, how does your report connect to those kinds of activities?
Well, it's actually very interesting in that a lot of these CHIPS efforts that you mentioned are capability driven, right? Certainly commons and Department of Commerce efforts are fab capabilities, research capabilities, specific DoD field capabilities. So everyone's building capabilities, but you can only succeed in the market. And we're sort of a free market country. You can only succeed if those capabilities have a business case. So I think there, and we've been discussing that actually, even in the development of the commerce of CHIPS efforts, you can't just have a capability driven effort and be successful, because you're competing with the whole world, right? Europe is doing CHIPS. Asia is doing CHIPS. The U.S. is doing CHIPS, and everyone's building more capability, and there's inevitably going to be oversupply in some areas. But what you really need to do is to drive demand. And we say that in a number of the recommendations. We need to drive demand. I mentioned the aggregation for driving demand is one idea. But we need to drive demand for security. We need to make security a valuable aspect of a defense system that is asked and paid for right up front. And today it's I hate to say it, but primarily it's an afterthought. It's all capability and timing. It's not security. Security needs to be on an even triad of saying this is valued by the government and we're willing to pay for it. And that's not just for defense. I would say that can take place, that can extend all the way into critical infrastructure, which is one of the markets that we're hoping to address with some of the CHIPS work. Because there is rightful skepticism that industrial policy is difficult and politically tricky. Of course it is. But this is too important an area to not try.
So on that note, does the report go into discussion of trusted foundries approaches versus quantifiable assurance approaches versus secure by design or whatever approaches in terms of enhancing security? You know, it sounds like you spent a lot of time in this report thinking about DoD as a customer and its approach to this global and fast-moving market. You know, how did you approach this issue of how to implement that security?
Well, I think ultimately the implementation has to be, you have to have a set of standards. And I think we mentioned some stuff about the development of a set of standards. You need a set of security standards. MQA is one idea. There's many other ideas out there. I've worked personally on workshops that are engaging with industry and what they would do. But I think what a crying need for the country is a set of security standards for microelectronics that can be used in the acquisition system, for example. And I personally believe that should be driven, it should be led by industry.
Sorry, those have been required by law in the previous versions of the National Defense Authorization Act, right?
Yes, no, they have been required by law. I think the aperture has been a little narrow. The approach has been primarily government-driven. I'm going to tell you what I need. And I personally, and I feel that it's much more effective since industry knows this field very, very, very well, and they know how to quantify, right, the value of something, that they need to be the driver, much like in the automotive standards. Industry needs to be the driver, and government needs to be the facilitator in this kind of thing. So government can play a big role in bringing people together, but ultimately it's the industry that needs to put together what practical standards can be implemented in order to vet security of microelectronics, because we don't have that. And you're right, it was mandated by law, but the result has been a very narrow aperture solution instead of a broader aperture with input from key industry players.
That's great. With that, I'm going to make that your last word in this conversation and start to do my last words. Thanks to Mike Fritzi and Jacob Wynn for this great discussion and for their work on this report. You can find their report on the ETI website and a link in the text box description below. Thank you to our team behind the camera, Daniel Park and Melanie Yu, for producing this podcast. If you enjoyed this podcast, please don't forget to hit that like button and subscribe to our channel to stay up to date with all of our latest content. Please visit our website and the NDIA website to find out all the great activities that the Emerging Technologies Institute and NDIA are running these days and into the future. Thank you so much for tuning into this week's episode of Emerging Tech Horizons, and we'll see you next time.